From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The new documentary, Suicide Bombers, features interviews with three failed suicide bombers, a recruiter, and a trainer. It will be shown on many PBS stations tomorrow night as part of the Wide Angle series. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with director Tom Roberts, who interviewed these men inside Israeli prisons, and Israel Goldvicht, who produced the film. Also, the Pullman Porter and his place in the labor movement and the making of the black middle class. We talk with journalist Larry Tye about his new book, Rising from the Rails. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album from the band Mr. Airplane Man. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Ousted Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein and 11 of his former top officials will appear in court tomorrow for a formal reading of the charges against them. NPR's Philip Reeves says security is a key issue.
It's certain that the security surrounding these events will be extremely tight. It's significant that although legal custody of Saddam Hussein has been transferred to the interim Iraqi government, he remains in American control. He's still being guarded by U.S. security forces. That reflects the level of security concerns surrounding these events and a larger concern that, for example, he might be subject to an attempt to free him.
NPR's Philip Reeves in Baghdad. The Federal Reserve has raised short-term interest rates for the first time in 4 years. Federal policymakers increased the federal funds rate by a quarter point to 1.25%. Stuart Hoffman is the chief economist with PNC Financial Services in Pittsburgh. He says the Fed has embarked on a careful effort to control inflation.
Sure, they've left the door open, but I think what they're saying is that this measured course is certainly a good way to start out, and right now is sort of their best guess at how they're going to proceed along this path towards higher rates.
The rate has been at 1%, its lowest level in 46 years. Secretary of State Colin Powell has demanded that Sudan give aid workers full access to the Darfur region, now considered the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Powell visited the region today while U.S. officials back home pressed the United Nations to act. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
Powell told NPR that he won some assurances from the government of Sudan to ease travel restrictions for aid workers and to crack down on the militias in Darfur.
As I discussed this matter with President Bashir and all of the other leaders here in Sudan, I said that the first thing that must be done is to break the back of the Janjaweed, the militias that have driven these people out of their homes.
At the United Nations, U.S. diplomats have been circulating a draft Security Council resolution that would impose an arms embargo and a travel ban on Janjaweed leaders. The resolution does not call for any action against the government in Khartoum, which aid workers say has been fomenting the ethnic cleansing campaign and backing the militias with air power. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
The two crew members on the International Space Station have embarked on a spacewalk designed to repair part of the craft's guidance system.
Okay, I copy. Or are you
if
ready?
All goes well, American Michael Fink and Russian Gennady Padalka could be outside their orbiting outpost for 6 hours. When they tried to make the repair last week, they were forced to abandon the effort after only 14 minutes because of a problem with Fink's spacesuit. In stocks, the Dow gained 22 points to close at 10,435. The Nasdaq was up 12 points to close at 2047. This is NPR News. In Miami, a citizens group is calling for a statewide audit of all of Florida's new electronic voting machines now to make sure that they can be trusted in November. NPR's Philip Davis has more.
The nonpartisan Miami Election Reform Coalition says after recent local elections there, officials discovered that electronic voting machines from election systems and software scrambled data and lost votes when election officials tried to do an after-election audit. Though a temporary solution has been found for the glitch, Sandy Whalen, the chairman of the group, says Governor Jeb Bush should order each county to do an audit of their new systems now before the November election.
We've got to look at the system. He must take it seriously. He's asking us to trust a system, and we're asking him to verify the system.
But Governor Bush says the voting machines have already been certified by the state as being accurate, and that he's satisfied that no new last-minute audits are needed. Philip Davis, NPR News, Miami.
The Israeli government said today that it will change the route of the barrier designed to separate Israel from Palestinians in the West Bank. The decision came after Israel's Supreme Court rejected plans for an 18-mile segment of the barrier, saying it would block Palestinian residents from access to their farms as well as schools in nearby cities. Israel says the barrier is needed to keep Palestinian suicide bombers from infiltrating Israel. Palestinians say the barrier is a land grab because it cuts off chunks of Palestinian territory in order to include Israeli settlements in the West Bank. In stocks, the S&P 500 gained 4 to close at 1140. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting improvements in the hospital work environment for nurses and their patients. On the web at rwjf.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Many people can't comprehend why someone would become a suicide bomber. A recruiter, a trainer, and three Palestinian suicide bombers whose missions failed in Israel speak for themselves in a new documentary called Suicide Bombers, which will be shown tomorrow night on many PBS stations as part of the series Wide Angle. The men were interviewed in Israeli prisons. The documentary was written and directed by my guest Tom Roberts, who also conducted the interviews. He lives in London. The film was produced by Israel Goldvicht, who lives in Jerusalem. We'll hear from Goldvicht a little later. Let's start with an excerpt of an interview that Tom Roberts recorded with an 18-year-old named Mohammed Abu Tayoun about why he had wanted to become a suicide bomber. Tayoun backed down just before he was supposed to detonate his bomb.
I want to become a martyr. I don't want this life. I want to be with God, to enjoy the second life. I want to go to paradise where there is happiness and joy, where there are no problems. There I get all I want. I get to be with the 70 virgins. Here our life is full of problems. We Palestinians prefer to die, just kill ourselves, rather than live this worthless life. Our life is worthless. We are hollow bodies leading a pointless life. Israelis enjoy their life. They go out at night, they have cafes and nightclubs. They travel all over the world. They go to America and Britain. We can't even leave Palestine.
Tom Roberts says it was difficult to convince Israeli authorities to grant permission to interview the failed suicide bombers. But once he was given permission, he was able to select from a large number of prisoners. I asked him how he chose the men featured in the documentary.
The majority of people that we spoke to, we asked if we could interview them immediately after their interrogation was complete, so that they were in effect fresh from the field, that they had not spent a long time in prison thinking about what they'd done and perhaps reorganizing their thoughts or retelling their story or manipulating their story, but in fact it comes straight out of interrogation. We subsequently followed up those initial interviews with quite an extensive range of contacts. So we did secondary and tertiary interviews with the same individuals, and we found, of course, they said the same things, although with less intensity than the first interview, so that we know that we didn't have a distortion in terms of their point of view.
Tom, let's talk about some of the people that you interviewed. The first suicide bomber interviewed on this documentary is Mohammed Abu Tayoun, an 18-year-old who entered Israel with a bag full of explosives, but then wavered and returned home before, deciding against detonating, mm-hmm. and he was arrested several days later. Why did he want to be a suicide bomber, or a martyr, as he would call it?
Well, I think that he is representative of a very large number of them. A young man, who is going to school, experiences the occupation, is aware that to be a shaheed, that is a martyr, is an exalted position. Girls are said to gather around the poster of the new shaheed and giggle and talk and admire. Everyone speaks in hushed terms about these individuals. So he certainly felt that maybe for nationalist reasons he should do something like this. I don't believe that he really, deep down inside, actually was so caught up in the ideology that he really wanted to do it and was driven to do it. I think that he played with the idea, and then, of course, he tells the story about how when he mentioned to his life's love, a woman, a young girl he had known for like 7 or 8 years and intended to marry, She was so appalled by the prospect that she became angry and cut off her contact with him. This curiously led him to, I think, probably become depressed. I don't know quite how he responded in emotional terms, but certainly it accelerated his decision to become a suicide bomber. Then all the ideologies and other elements that are used to buttress these people and get them on the mission were put into play.
Before the mission, he made his video declaration of martyrdom. What did he have to do on this video?
Well, generally, I mean, I think we've all seen them on the news. Are often given a piece of paper to read, which is a tract, a political tract, justifying your actions, proclaiming your belief in Allah and the importance of martyrdom operations. It then goes on to say that you're doing this, you know, in retaliation for X or Y, and calling on your colleagues to continue these kind of actions. It's a self-justifying thing, but it has another very important mechanism. It's very difficult, of course, for any individual to wrap themselves with exposures and press the trigger. In Palestinian society, the social structure is very tight. You live amongst your family and friends, and there's little opportunity to travel and families, and the community is very, very close. And what happens is that when you appear and you give this declaration, you effect are called a living martyr. That is, an individual who is, in effect, already dead, even though your heart is beating. And once you've made that declaration, it is socially impossible for you to back out of it. It's kind of like they've slammed the door and you have no alternative but to carry out the operation.
Why couldn't he do it? What was the attack supposed to be, and why did he decide at the last minute that he just couldn't go through with it?
As I recall, he was going to target a bus, go one of the typical bus bombings, get on a very crowded bus and press the button. In actual fact, I think he was a confused young man who was there to carry out this mission more for psychological reasons than for political or religious ones. Now, I went to visit his house. He lived in a refugee camp outside of Nablus called Balata. And it was clear that his family had some affluence. His father had been a construction company owner. He'd done small projects like municipal swimming pools and things of that sort. And as I looked around the house, I saw two pictures on the wall of what looked like to be a grandfather figure, who looked down in a very stern and very rigid way amongst, you know, at this family. I later discovered, in fact, it was photographs of his father, and I watched his father very carefully, and I found him to be a tremendous autocrat. His wife seemed to be in fear of him. His kids jumped to his order. And one can imagine that Abu Tayyum was a young man who felt he had very much something to prove to his father, an element of I will be respected if I carry out this mission. I think there were a lot of psychological reasons. The girlfriend and the father add that to the wider political the general environment he was in. And he was motivated to go do this. But in his heart, I don't think he had the courage, and I don't think he had, if you will, the rigidity of thinking, the narrowness of thinking that made it possible for him to push that button.
Well, one of the things he tells you in the interview is that he thought, what if I end up killing Israelis who actually favor peace? And he decides that, you know, there might be people who are killed who are pro-peace, and he wouldn't feel good about that. And he offers that as one of the reasons why he couldn't go through with it.
Well, I think undoubtedly that was part of the reasoning or part of his, I think, justification. I think, in fact, he knows who he's talking to in this interview, and he's also just been interrogated, so he's trying to put the best possible light on the reason he didn't go through with it. And he's deeply shamed by his failure. You can see that, the way he holds his head, the way he tries to say that, of course, God decided he was not going to be a bomber, and therefore he was made to be confused by God. In other words, it wasn't him who was confused, and it wasn't him that should be shamed, or he suffer the accusations of being a coward. He just couldn't quite do it because God was preventing him from doing it. And I think deep down, he was probably more decent an individual, ultimately, than someone who can take that extra step. And that's not to justify or excuse it, but that's to understand that the ideology that is preached, that there are thousands of men who just are desperate to go do this and blow themselves up, is actually propaganda. And there are actually very few individuals who really, truly want to do this.
So what do you think? If he is released at any point and goes back home, what would his reputation be? Would he be considered a coward? Would he be punished by his own community for not having followed through on his pledge to become a suicide bomber?
I think that's very unlikely. I don't think he would be treated, he certainly wouldn't be treated as a hero. He was a failure in terms of the ideology and the propaganda, and therefore they don't really want to call attention to that. It's easier if you just forget about him and make no fuss or noise. So I don't think he would have any great difficulty, and I certainly don't think he had any justification to fear that he would be harmed on his return. I don't think there's any evidence that failed suicide bombers go back and are executed or killed or assaulted.
Is the fact that he couldn't go through with it taken into account in his sentencing?
Well, yes. I mean, they can't sentence suicide bombers who are successful, and those who...
True. But, yeah. I mean, is there this element of, well, you know, maybe you're not so bad because you decided against it at the last minute?
The sentence that a failed suicide bomber receives, he will get about 15 to 17 years in prison. If a suicide bomber failed for technical reasons, otherwise they attempted to press the button and failed, they would get a higher sentence. And those who have been successful in terms that they've sent other people to carry out, they built a bomb and organized a trip and sent other people to kill, and that trip was successful, will serve a life sentence for every individual that was killed in the operation. So there are people in Israeli prisons with sentences of 800 years or 1,200 years. In that sense, Abu Tayyoun would get a sentence of 15 to 18 years, and that would be relatively lenient.
My guest is Tom Roberts, director of the documentary Suicide Bombers, which will be shown tomorrow night on many PBS stations. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Tom Roberts, directed the documentary Suicide Bombers, featuring interviews with failed suicide bombers who are now in Israeli prisons. Also joining us is the producer of the film, Israel Goldvicht, who lives in Jerusalem. Let me ask you about two other interviews that you did for this documentary. You interviewed two men who recruit suicide bombers and build the bombs. Israel, would you describe the bus bombing that these two men were behind?
Well, it's bus number 37 in Haifa. It was populated by young people. Quite a lot of them are school teenagers and so on. And the operation started in the city of Hebron in the West Bank, which is quite far from Haifa. And they recruited somebody who agreed to do the mission, but then changed his mind. So they picked up somebody else, and a truck, Palestinian truck driver, we were told, with an Israeli ID card, i.e. somebody who lives within either Greater Jerusalem or within the Green Line, took him to Haifa, and he went to this bus and exploded, and 17 people were killed, right? Am I right, Tom?
17 were killed and 50 injured. I think 9 were under the age of 18. And it occurred after a lull, so it came as a big shock to the Israelis when it took place.
Now, one of these two men that you interviewed recruited the bomber, and the other built the bomb and prepared the bomber. These two men that we're talking about, what was their motivation? Why were they so deeply committed to killing Israelis?
I think you have to start, to answer that question, you have to start from a slightly different perspective, which is to look at the difference between the suicide bomber, the actual button pusher, if you will, and those who send him. Those who send him are, at least in our experience, very, very committed individuals who believe deeply in the ideology, who are politically active, who see themselves as warriors, great warriors fighting the Israeli state. But I think in the end, their hearts are really filled with hatred. And if you stay to the end of the film, you hear Majdi, who tells a story at the age of 12, that when he was at the age of 12 coming back from school, he was confronted by an Israeli border patrolman who Majdi claims slapped him across the face for no reason whatever, and sought, many years later, sought revenge for the humiliation of that. Now, how much of that slap was in his own mind and how much he contributed to it and what actually happened at that point, you know, we'll never know. But Monchi's heart is there's no question, is full of hatred and anger.
Now, the recruiter you spoke to tells suicide bombers that they will be rewarded in paradise for their actions. What does the recruiter tell his recruits about the rewards they will get in paradise?
Well, they're very, very extensive. I mean, everyone seems to focus on the 72 virgins that the Shahid, the martyr, will be given once he gets to paradise. I'm not quite sure what happens to the female suicide bombers, but in fact, there are many other rewards, and I think one of the most significant ones is that the ideology, or the, if you will, the religious fundamentalism preaches that 70 members of the suicide bombers will get a free ticket, an automatic absolution of any sins, and they will automatically go to paradise. So the suicide bomber can look forward to this luxurious, wonderful life of sexual ecstasy, surrounded by brothers and sisters and aunts and uncles and cousins and nephews, all of which he knows that because of his actions, they're guaranteed to make it to paradise. So you have a replication, if you will, of the Arab family, of the extended family in paradise. And then when you hear them describe the kind of world they're going to be in, rivers flowing of non-alcoholic wine or of milk and honey and fruit juice and water and so forth, you begin to realize that what they're describing is the idea of what paradise would be for a desert or nomadic people.
But one more point, if I may.
Yeah.
The fact is that those who recruit them, when they were asked by Tom about why aren't you yourself volunteering, so they do talk about doing it one day, but they talk about themselves as the seed, as those who need to stay alive to continue, the struggle. And experts will tell us, told us actually, that you won't find members of family members of leaders of the Palestinian groups who are participating in it as members, as suicidals.
What did you learn from the person you interviewed who actually built bombs about how the suicide belts are designed?
Well, it's on one level very, very simple technology. It's a small, usually a plywood construction that you can use other materials, with a thin layer of very high explosive, plastic explosive. And on top of that are piled nuts and bolts, nails, and things of that sort, so that when the blast takes place, the shrapnel rips out. It's made very thin and worn around the waist. And the technology is simple. You need a detonator, you need a switch. That's relatively all you need. It's a very simple kind of thing. They rarely make them so that they wear them front and back, so sometimes they're mounted on the back. And as he explains quite clearly, that the simple instructions you're to receive is when you get on the bus, if the majority of people are behind you, you turn your back so that if you have a wearing a backpack, it explodes in that direction. In other words, you face the bomb in the direction where the majority of people are, whether it's on the front or back, to carry out the greatest number of casualties. In a confined space, this weapon is truly devastating, and it tears people to shreds, really, and arms, legs are ripped off, and the shrapnel can do very, very severe damage. The blast wave itself is enough to kill. Even if you aren't hit by the shrapnel, the blast wave will rupture internal injuries and internal organs, rather, and cause very, very, very severe injuries. So in a small, confined place, if you do it on the street corner, the casualty levels will be much lower. So they need a confined space, a pizza shop or a bus, something of that sort.
And the suicide bombers are told that they should enter, if they're bombing a bus, that they should enter the bus full of peace and tranquility so that they don't draw attention to themselves.
And it's not painful at all. I mean, it's like a needle.
Right. They're told that it won't be painful.
At all.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, I think that's probably the case. I mean, this explosive is so severe and so instantaneous that the bomber is torn to pieces and dies an instantaneous death. So, you know, but I mean, you're right. They're told in religious language, you know, and enter with peace and tranquility because you're one step away from going to paradise. That you're about to carry out God's mission, and so there are reports of suicide bombers observed just before they hit the switch with a big smile on their face. I don't know if that's true, but I've heard reports of that sort, and one can imagine that if you really really submit to the ideology that you may well convince yourself that you're about to take the trip of your life.
Well, in fact, one of the teenaged failed suicide bomber, somebody who had second thoughts about it, tells you that one of the reasons why he wanted to do it in the first place is that he saw two martyrs with smiles on their faces.
Precisely.
Dead martyrs, yeah.
The interesting thing about Bilal, that's who you're referring to, you mentioned as a would-be suicider. I personally come to the conclusion, this is a personal judgment, that Bilal never really was a suicide bomber. He reacted to an event in the street, as a young man might do, seeing two individuals who were shot in a confrontation with Israeli troops. We don't know the circumstances or what really happened. He felt a sense of outrage, went to people he knew that could organize these. And that, one of the things he did say, and we do point out in the film, is that he said to them, quick, can we do it very quickly? Can we do it speedily because I may change my mind? He wasn't really truly an individual who had absorbed and believed in all this. It was an instantaneous reaction, virtually. And had there been some delay, I think, before he carried out his mission, he never would have gotten that far. As it was, when he got there, he just decided he wasn't going to do this and didn't believe in it. And to this day, he's different from the others. He does not believe in it. He doesn't support it. He doesn't want to talk about politics. He realizes he made a mistake and wants to get out of Israeli prison and leave the area, leave the country.
In fact, he didn't grow up in Israel. He was born in Kuwait, grew up in Jordan, and, you know, was already a boy when his family moved to a village on the West Bank.
Exactly right, and I think that there are many different elements that make the suicide bomber who he or she is, and of course one of those is the social experience. One of those is the life inside the West Bank or in Gaza. It's a very difficult life. There was an intifada before where the young men of the community rose up and effectively overthrew their elders and carried out this low intensity. Campaign against the Israelis. Then you had eight, 9 years of the Oslo peace process, which gave the Palestinians ultimately very, very little. They got very little reward for this process. And although it was relatively quiet, it was a time of great frustration for both sides. Both sides were enormously frustrated. They couldn't progress this peace process much further. And then the extremely violent Second Intifada. And I think if you grew up in those conditions and that's all you know, you are ripe for the ideologies that are used to recruit suicide bombers.
And the teenagers today who are becoming suicide bombers are that generation that grew up during the first intifada and the second.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I want to thank you both very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Very much.
Thank you.
Tom Roberts and Israel Goldvick made the documentary Suicide Bombers. It will be shown on the PBS Wide Angle series tomorrow night. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In the late 1800s, one of the best jobs a former slave could get was working as a Pullman porter. Coming up, why the Pullman Company wanted to hire dark-skinned ex-slaves. We talk with Larry Tye. His new book is about the Pullman porters and the making of the black middle class. Also, Ken Tucker reviews the new album from the female rock duo Mr. Airplane Man. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the 1860s, George Pullman started a train company that had sleeping cars and promised traveling around the country in luxury. The passengers were assured of special treatment by the Pullman porters. The Pullman Company intentionally hired black men as the porters. It was an exhausting job that was sometimes demeaning, but it was also one of the best jobs available to African-American men. In fact, the Pullman porters helped create and enlarge the black middle class. The Pullman Company terminated its sleeping car service in the late 1960s. Journalist Larry Tye has written a new book called Rising from the Rails, Pullman Porters and the Making of the Black Middle Class. You write that by the 1960s, Pullman porters had come to personify the grinning servant, the Uncle Tom, but the Pullman porters had been real agents of social change in their prime. In what ways did they help create social change?
In a couple ways. They first started in the 1930s. They launched the first successful black trade union in America. And this was a union that did all the conventional things that a union does in terms of giving them substantially more wages, shorter working hours, general better working conditions. But much more important than that, it gave them a sense of self-respect and a sense of identity that they weren't just these nameless, faceless guys who worked on the cars. They actually gave them name badges, which were very important things for these men who had either been called George or been called by conventional profanities over their years on the Pullman cars. And they were called George because in the tradition of a slave being named after a slave master, they were seen as the servants of George Pullman, the man who launched the company they worked for.
George Pullman started hiring Pullman porters shortly after the end of slavery, and he intentionally wanted to hire dark-skinned ex-slaves. What was his reasoning?
His reasoning was twofold. One, it was that they would come and work for him for whatever price, however low the price he decided to pay them, and he paid them next to nothing, and that they would work as long and as hard as he would demand of them, and he demanded them working 100 or more hours a week. But the more interesting reason that he hired them was he was trying to sell railroad customers back then on a whole new concept, on the concept of overnight travel. And his sleeping cars were more than double the price of a conventional railroad ticket. So he had to convince these passengers that they were going to get such ultimate service, such luxurious service, that it was worth paying this, what seemed like an extremely high fee. And who better to convince them that they were going to be waited on brilliantly than ex-slaves who embodied for these white passengers the whole notion of service.
What was the service that they were asked to provide?
They were asked to do everything from serve as a chambermaid to a valet, shining shoes, nursing hangovers, taking care of passengers who were drunk or who had lost their temper. They were basically asked to do everything that somebody would do in a hotel on the entire service staff. And they were the only service staff on this railroad trip across country that could often take 3 or 4 days. So they did every job that was asked them.
Now, you mentioned that there was another reason why George Pullman wanted to hire dark-skinned African-Americans, and that was to clearly differentiate between the porters and the passengers, because these were sleeper cars. People were going to be undressing, preparing for bed. What was his reasoning there?
There was a sense of the social separation, that these should be men who were so clearly from a different world than his white passengers that nobody could ever see themselves as running into these guys in another situation off the train. And the blackness of their skin was seen as one more way to differentiate them from their white passengers and to say, these are people who are different. They are almost invisible to you, and you should not worry that you would ever be embarrassed if you're in a compromising position with them on the train in terms of ever having to see them again in your other life.
There was a whole rule book that he published regulating the porters' interactions with their passengers. What were some of the things in the rule book?
There were some extraordinary things in the rule book. Some of the things that I found most interesting and were most offensive to the Pullman porters were that they should use different colored blankets than either the passengers or the white conductors to make sure that no white employee of George Pullman or no white who rode on his train should ever have to worry about using the same pillow or blanket that a black porter had used. There were rules governing everything from how to fold a sheet to how to swat a fly, that everything. George Pullman believed in a system of management that didn't leave any detail to the discretion of his employees generally, and particularly to his black Pullman porters. So he specified how they should dust the passenger's jacket when they were leaving the train, on exactly what they should do in shining shoes. Every little detail was written down in his hundreds of rules, in his thick rule book that every porter was required to carry every moment that they were on the train.
Do you think that African Americans in the late 1800s and early 1900s considered this a good job?
It was actually considered one of the two best jobs you could have in the black community back then, particularly for a black man. They used to say, there was a wonderful expression, Pullman and postal were the best things that a black man in that era could do, and it meant that working for the post office was one of the best jobs in terms of having higher pay and having a job with more status, and the only thing that beat that in terms of blue-collar work in the black world back then was being a Pullman porter.
What was the life like, the day-to-day life of a Pullman porter?
The day-to-day life was one of having to largely wear a mask that essentially allowed them to accept some of the humiliation, some of the abuse that they took from their passengers, and not give it back to them. They lived, in a sense, in two different worlds. One was a world that they showed and the face that they showed to their white passengers, and that was a perpetually obliging one. And the other was a world that they live in with fellow Pullman porters, where they actually develop their own language and their own way of learning how to absorb this abuse without giving it back, that gave them very much of a schizophrenic world back then.
Where did they sleep?
They slept in the smoking room, which doubled as the men's toilet. That they had a little curtain that separated them from the toilets and the wash basins, and they had an old couch back there, and they were given at most 4 hours to sleep at night. Now, in fact, that sleep was interrupted any time a white passenger, a white man, came in to use the toilet or to have a poker game into the late night in the smoking room or just to have a smoke. And so it was 4 hours maximum sleep, perpetual interruptions, and a very uncomfortable old couch separated by a thin curtain that was where they were supposed to get enough sleep to function for their 100 hours of work a month.
Must have been hard to function and hard to be cheerful with so little sleep.
A little hard to be both of those, absolutely. And yet these guys managed to do it for careers that spanned 30 and 40 years, which was a function of two things, of how few other choices they had, and of how the upside of the job, the idea of being able to travel the country, being able to absorb lessons from their wealthy and interesting white passengers, that all of that looked so good compared to what other choices they had in those days, that they were willing to absorb the downsides of the job for all those years.
What impact do you think it had on the porters and on the families of the porters for them to be exposed to the travel and to so many different people?
We can see directly, that's the big piece of this book in terms of trying to understand how they absorbed those lessons and what role it played in their lives. They came to see the value of education. Their white passengers perpetually talked to them about the importance of getting advanced degrees or going to college at all, and they learned those lessons and saw that the kids could get schooling. They learned how to invest the money that they made, and it started out as very little money, but after they had a union, they had enough to actually think about what they would invest it in, and they saw America's leading financiers riding the train with them. And these are people they spent 3 and 4 days with, and they learned really concrete lessons. One porter after another would tell me the great investments they made, which in many cases let them get off the railroads or at a minimum let them put their kids through school. They absorbed the whole lesson of how the white world worked in ways that they went on to put into use in their own life, and that let them become, if not themselves, through their children and grandchildren, the founding members of the black middle class.
My guest is Larry Tye, author of the new book Rising from the Rails. We'll talk more about the Pullman porters after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guest is Larry Tye. His new book is called Rising from the Rails, Pullman Porters and the Making of the Black Middle Class. How did the Pullman Porters start to unionize?
They tried to unionize originally in the late 1800s, and every attempt to unionize was quashed. George Pullman had a monopoly on sleeping car service. He despised the notion of unions, whether they were white unions or black unions, and he managed to fire workers or do anything he had to do to intimidate them. But there was a slow process that began in the mid-1920s, where a guy named A. Philip Randolph, who was not a Pullman porter, came in and began a process of unionizing them, and it took a full 12 years from the day they started the process to the day they actually got a union to make this effort work. And Randolph and all of his lieutenants went through dire poverty, experienced brutality at the hands of the Pullman Company, and they were never discouraged enough that they one way or another managed to keep fighting the battle, whether it was in the courts, whether it was through regulatory agencies, and most importantly, trying to keep the Pullman porters on board with him. And he miraculously succeeded in doing it through this long 12-year effort.
What are some of the specific things that the Pullman Company tried to do to discourage the African-American workers from unionizing?
They hired thugs, and this came out in a court case, to beat up one of Randolph's top lieutenants. They fired dozens, and some people say hundreds, of Pullman porters who were involved with the union effort. They went to court and did everything they could to quash every effort there. They tried to lobby Congress and successfully did that to pass laws that made it very difficult to unionize the porters. And they did all these things over a consistent period of 12 years, led at one point by Abe Lincoln's son, who took over for George Pullman as the head of the Pullman Company, Robert Todd Lincoln. And he was one of the best union busters of anybody the Pullman Company had ever had on board.
Hmm. Once the Pullman porters did unionize, what impact did that have on the labor movement?
It had two impacts in the labor movement. One is it helped to desegregate the labor movement. In the early days, Randolph, A. Philip Randolph, and his porters union were the only black union who was affiliated. They were not a formal part of the AFL, but they were an affiliated union. And Randolph kept pushing for full status, equal status within the AFL hierarchy. He would go to every executive committee meeting and push for all the black unionists to get more equal treatment. And he was a perpetual thorn in the side of everybody who ran the AFL-CIO for about 25 years until he started seeing his efforts yield some results. It had a profound psychological effect on blacks who were trying to unionize to see as visible a workers as the Pullman porters were successfully create their own union. And then he yielded practical results by pushing the union movement to accept blacks on an equal basis.
You know, it's still registering on me that President Lincoln's son became the head of the Pullman Company and was so anti-union. Is it going too far to say that Lincoln signed the proclamation to free the slaves and then his son made sure that some of those ex-slaves or descendants of slaves didn't make a lot of money?
Actually, the Pullman porters over the years had their own expression. Lincoln freed the slaves and his son re-enslaved them. And they didn't feel it was going too far to say that, and that's precisely what Robert Todd Lincoln did. He was as vehement as George Pullman had ever been in terms of trying to limit salaries, limit any potential for promotion, basically limit the opportunities for his Pullman porters and keep them as chattel slaves. And I think that Pullman porters over the years found that a really grim but ironic situation they were perpetually pointing to.
Do you think that the Pullman porters or their union had much of an influence on the civil rights movement?
I think they had a profound influence. If I can tell you a quick story about when we think of the beginning of the civil rights movement, we often date it from the Montgomery bus boycott. And the Montgomery bus boycott began when Rosa Parks was asked to step to the back of the bus, refused to do it, and was arrested. The first person that she summoned to the jail to bail her out of jail was a Pullman porter named Edgar D. Nixon. She knew Nixon because she worked for him. He had an office that he held two hats in that office, and one was as head of the local chapter of the NAACP. The other was as head of the local chapter of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. And Nixon had been waiting for years to have just the right test case to try this boycott of the Montgomery bus system. He had one problem, though, in trying to organize this boycott, and that was that he was a Pullman porter who was out on the road so much that he couldn't be there to be at all the meetings. So he looked around town for who would be somebody that could be the perfect front man for him in this boycott, and he saw this young minister who had just graduated from Boston University named Martin Luther King, who happened to have the biggest church in town. And he called King and asked him, would you be willing to come to a meeting I'm organizing of ministers to talk about what we do in organizing a boycott? And King said, give me some time to think about it. Call me back. So Nixon calls 13 other prominent ministers in Montgomery and convinces them to come to a meeting the next day. He calls back King and says, what about it, Reverend King? And King says, okay, I'll come. And Nixon says to him, that's great because I've organized a meeting for tomorrow at your church. And he saw King as perfect. He represented a wealthy church, a large church, and he was young and impressionable enough that Nixon could pull the strings in making this boycott happen with Martin King as the front man to start with. And I think that's an interesting story to me because it's a metaphor for what porters did throughout the years in the civil rights movement, that they used their union halls, turned over their union halls for civil rights meetings. They bankrolled the civil rights movement at a time when there was no money to support civil rights activities. And their people behind the scenes were critical actors from the earliest days of the civil rights movement.
As part of your research for this book, you found as many surviving Pullman porters, former Pullman porters that you could, and tried to interview them. You also interviewed family members of former Pullman porters. How did you find these people?
I had been a journalist for 20 years, and the most difficult job I think I've ever done in those 20 years was finding these Pullman porters. I did everything that I called on every trick and every convention that I'd learned during those years as being a journalist, from putting ads in railroad retirement magazines, putting ads in every black newspaper in every railroad city in America. I had Amtrak helping me track them down. I found their old employment data that was left behind by the Pullman Company and tried to track them down. That way, I wrote letters to probably 500 Pullman workers from those old Pullman Company records. I talked to black ministers in major cities across the country. I talked to civil rights leaders. And those things yielded precious few porters. The technique that actually worked the best, and it shouldn't be surprising, but it surprised me and I was late to come to it, was talking to people who ran nursing homes in cities, in major cities across the country. And they tended to know the Pullman porters were out of the normal network of social interaction. They were so old and so tuned out from the normal networks. They were in their late 80s, in their 90s. One was 102. And the people who knew who they were and where they were people who were running the nursing homes that they were living in. And in every city, once you found one Pullman porter, they would generally be able to lead you to others. But finding that first one was a wonderful challenge, and I ended up coming up with dozens of them, but it was really difficult and a real challenge.
Now, Pullman porters have figured into a lot of movies, even songs. Do you have any favorites of all the ones you poured through?
First of all, I found fascinating the way the porters were always background characters in the movies. It wasn't a movie from the Thin Man movies to an entire era of movies from the 1920s to about the 1950s where there was a train that you didn't see this obliging, smiling Pullman porter character who generally had no speaking part in the movie. And they were the perfect backdrop, partly because they conjured up this whole era of elegance. And when they said things, it was generally roles as the compliant, obliging fool. But I think that there were a bunch of authors who managed to go a little deeper, and one of them, my favorite, was Studs Terkel. And he had interviewed E.D. Nixon, this guy who brought Martin Luther King into the civil rights movement, in an oral history that Terkel was doing of the Great Depression. And he quotes Nixon as saying, a Pullman porter can always get into a conversation anywhere. He walked into a barber shop, somebody would say, I didn't see you around here. Or maybe they'd notice his pants with a stripe. Everybody listened because they knowed the Pullman porter been everywhere and they never been anywhere themselves. And I think that's precisely what happened for in sketching out the Pullman porter's role. He was a guy to be revered in the black community. And I did an interview at one point with Julian Bond, the chairman of the NAACP, And Bond said, to start out the hour-long interview, he said, "I've got really nothing to tell you. I didn't know much about the Pullman Porters." And he proceeded to describe how, as a little kid growing up in rural Georgia, he had seen these elegant-looking black men dressed in their fine blue uniforms and had seen them walking down the street as men of grace and men of achievement. And he had no idea what the uniform was about. He didn't really know what their job was. But these were men in the black community who stood out and who were seen as the most prominent and respected men in that world. They had been everywhere. They had seen things nobody else had. And they shared their experiences when they came back from every train trip.
Well, Larry Tye, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Larry Tye's new book is called Rising from the Rails, Pullman Porters and the Making of the Black Middle Class. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews a new CD by the female rock duo Mr. Airplane Man. This is Fresh Air. Mr. Airplane Man is a Boston-based duo that takes its name from a Howlin' Wolf song. The band features singer-guitarist Margaret Garrett and drummer-organist Tara McManus. Their third album, Come On, DJ, has drawn comparisons to another twosome, the White Stripes. But rock critic Ken Tucker says these two women are using the blues for their own purposes, not to prove sincerity and authenticity like many white musicians do, but to express intimate, immediate emotions. Here's his review.
That cover of Howlin' Wolf's Ask for Water, recorded in Memphis by the two women who make up Mr. Airplane Man, is pretty nervy stuff. Discordant, unmindful of conventional blues rhythms, but getting the spirit of the music right. Mournful, angry, and resigned. Margaret Garrett and Tara McManus fill their third album with original songs and covers that suggest a desire to avoid the sound of the present day while tapping into contemporary ambivalence and doubt. They do it again on an original like Don't Know Why. If you were to just read a lyric sheet for that song, it would sound like something from the now buried TV show Sex and the City. Woman at home, waiting for a phone call from a guy that never comes, feels bad, sits around wondering why, and wondering why she takes this emotional abuse. But the way Garrett sings it, she avoids any hint of self-pity. And her guitar and McManus's drums lay out a canvas of music upon which Mr. Airplane Man can paint expressionistic portraits of frustration and resentment.
I'll make it to you. I'll do it for you.
That song, Fallen, with its refrain, "There ain't nothing I can do, I'm fallen for you," portrays love as an inescapable trap. It takes the idea of the blues as a music of fatalism, of doomed unhappiness, and turns it into a music of delirium, of giving yourself over to an emotion, no matter what it may cost the singer. This idea of losing control, of giving into one's bleakest hopes and desires, is something you just don't hear in the most popular music of the moment. From Missy Elliott to Norah Jones to Christina Aguilera, music by pop women tends to be the stuff of empowerment, of taking control of bad situations and making them right, or at least bearable. At the same time, there's nothing weak or indecisive about the women of Mr. Airplane Man. The vehemence of their music guarantees that. Just listening to the drumming on this song, Make You Mine, proves my point. Airplane Man ranges across decades in their music. The 50s stomp of Red Light, the 60s psychedelia of Sun Going Down, the 70s punk rock slam of the title track. But what the album comes down to is the solidarity of these two women's friendship. They've known each other for 20 years, since they were 10, and met at a summer camp in New Hampshire. How un-rock and roll is that? But how rock and roll is their music? Plenty.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Come On, DJ by Mr. Airplane Man. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Easter Island, a novel of two women on parallel quests, decades apart, and the remote island that connects their stories, by Jennifer Vanderbees. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actor and director Mario Van Peebles talks about his new film Badass, in which he plays his father, actor and director Melvin Van Peebles. Badass tells the story of the making of Melvin's now classic film, Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song, which opened the door for black action films. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.